We have a holiday coming up. It begins, what is it, Thursday night, right? Is it Thursday night or for Wednesday night?
Thursday night.
Thursday night. Okay. I don't know if Hanukkah ever starts on Wednesday night. So Thursday night is the first night of Hanukkah. So we're not even going to be much into the swing of things before we have a Shabbos Hanukkah to worry about. On Hanukkah, of course, is the holiday where we celebrate two things. We celebrate the miracle of the oil, which is found in the Gemara, where when the Maccabees rededicated the Beis HaMikdash, they only found enough oil to last for one day, and it burned for 8 days. And we also celebrate, arguably, more importantly from today's perspective, the victory of the Jews over the Syrian Greeks, that even though we were a much smaller army compared to the Syrian Greeks, nevertheless, we prevailed. Apparently, we merited at that time to prevail against our enemies and restore a Jewish commonwealth in Eretz Yisrael for a few hundred years until the Romans took over. And we did not merit in the times of destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We rebelled against Rome and were not successful at that time at throwing off the yoke of the oppressors. But apparently it wasn't the plan that the Jews were supposed to control Eretz Yisrael for those couple hundred years. And they established the holiday of Hanukkah when they were able to restore the Beis HaMikdash with the lighting of candles and the recitation of Hallel for 8 days. Also, one of the sources, I think, in the second book of Maccabees. There are four different books called Sefer HaMakkabim, the book of Maccabees, which are not found in the Tanakh. They are found in the biblical canon, Lahavdil, of some Christian sects. And it's these Christians who actually preserve these books, which are of Jewish provenance. But apparently the sages did not feel that these books were written with sufficient Ruach HaKodesh, or divine inspiration, to be included in the Tanakh, in the Jewish biblical canon. But there are four old Jewish books called the Books of Maccabees. And as opposed to the books of Shmuel and Melachim, which were divided by the Christians when the Archbishop of Canterbury was dividing the Tanakh into prokim, into chapters, to make referencing it easier, a division that has persisted to this day and is still used by Jews. The chapter and verse divisions are of Christian origin, and yet the Jews adopted this reference because it's just a convenient point of reference. So if you could imagine if this were going on today, this wouldn't fly in Bnei Brak. They'd be Pashkevilim everywhere that we're using a Christian division to divide the Tanakh. How could it be? But in any event, that slowly caught on in medieval Jewry to divide the Tanakh into a prokim. So when the Christians divided the Tanakh into a prokim, possibly this division actually goes back earlier to when the books were copied into Greek, and Greek books were written on papyrus, so they weren't as strong as Hebrew books. So they had to break it down into smaller volumes. So they divided the books of Shmuel and Melachim into two, one Shmuel and two Shmuel, Shmuel Aleph, what we call today Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Beis, and the Melachim Aleph and Melachim Beis. So there, it was originally one book, the Sefer Shmuel and Sefer Melachim, and Sefer Divrei Hayomim, which were divided each into two books at a later date. But the four books of Maccabees are not four parts of one long work, one original long work, but in fact, the books of Maccabees are four separate works, some of which were originally written in Greek and some of which were originally written in Hebrew. The first book of Maccabees, which is considered to be the most reliable, says was originally written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into Greek, and then the original Hebrew was lost. So then you can find versions that you could buy in Israel, different scholarly bookstores, where you have the original, where you have it translated back into a biblical style Hebrew. I think once I obtained a copy of the first book of Maccabees, it's probably my parents' house somewhere. I didn't bring it here. That was translated into like biblical style Hebrew, where the person who translated was attempting to reconstruct the original Hebrew text, sort of. I think there were some modern Hebrewisms thrown in there, though. It was a little bit weird. But in any event, that's the first book of Maccabees. The other books of Maccabees, I think, were originally written in Greek. And the second book of Maccabees, I think it is, says that the reason that Hanukkah is 8 days long is because the Jews could not celebrate Sukkot that year because they were busy fighting for their lives. They're putter. It's not that they did something wrong. when you're engaged in the middle of a war, fighting for your literal lives, spiritual and physical lives, so then you're exempt from observing any all the mitzvahs. So not just the Aliyah of Sukkot, they were exempt from observing all the mitzvahs of Sukkot. So they celebrated for 8 days in Kislev. It wasn't an attempt to celebrate Sukkot 2 months late, more than 2 months late. But it was just they felt bad that they didn't observe Sukkot this year. It's not that they did something wrong, but they wanted to make an 8 day holiday. And anyway, they had something to celebrate the restoration of the Beis Hamikdash and the victory over the Assyrian Greeks. So they established the holiday of Hanukkah. So the main mitzvahs of Hanukkah are the lighting of candles, which take place each night of Hanukkah, and the recitation of Hallel, normally recited in the morning, but it could be recited any time of day for those who do not recite it at Shacharis. It's different. Jewish communities have taken the festivity of Hanukkah to different levels. Alpi Kabbalah, you know, I always learned when I was a kid growing up that on Rosh Hashanah, God judges you for your sins. On Yom Kippur, God seals your judgment. And if you still do tshuva, there's still time to repent by Hoshana Rabbah. So you have a little bit of extra time on Hoshana Rabbah. And there's no source for this in Chazal exactly, but later Kabbalistic sources may say something like this. And even later Kabbalistic sources say, if you didn't repent by Hoshana Rabbah, so you still have until Hanukkah. So that's why many Hasidim, especially on the last day of Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah, when all the candles are lit, so they treat it really as like a quasi-holiday. They're going with a Shtreimlach, Shabbos clothing and Shabbos hats. They really turned Hanukkah into a real holiday. It's not even like Purim. Purim, it already says in the Maharil, in the classical compendium of Western Ashkenazic Minhagim, it already says there that you're supposed to wear big day Shabbos. You're supposed to wear fancier clothes on Purim than a regular day. That's already in Tanakh. It calls it Yom Mishta V'Simcha. The whole day is a day of happiness. But on Hanukkah, really, the days are total, total weekdays. There's really nothing festive to them at all. There's just things that we have to do to commemorate the miracles of the time period of Hanukkah. But nevertheless, we Jews like holidays. We don't like to let something pass us by. It's like Tu B'Shvat. So Tu B'Shvat in the times of the Mishnah was Mamish, not a holiday at all. It had nothing to do with holidays. It just had to do with the tithes, and maybe for certain halachos of Orla, that the holiday of Tu B'Shvat was relevant. Well, it wasn't celebrated at all. But now we've turned it into more of a holiday. We don't say Tachanun. Some groups have a Seder on Tu B'Shvat. So they really turned it into a holiday. So we've done the same with Hanukkah. So Hanukkah, we turned it to more of a holiday. We like to have parties, which again, if they're done properly, the Rama writes in Shulchan Aruch, that even though there's no requirement to have a suda, there's no requirement to eat anything per se over Hanukkah. If you do eat over Hanukkah and you put in some Divrei Torah, you make it into a meal where you talk about words of Torah, you talk about the victory, you talk about the miracles that God performed for us. So it turns it into a sort of sudas mitzvah. So that's why the custom is to try to have meals over Hanukkah. But if you're just enjoying the meal, if you have a Shabbos meal and you gorge yourself on fancy meats and wines and all these things, so even if you don't mention any Divrei Torah at all, that might not be recommended, but it's still a Kiyum HaMitzvah. You still get a points for Oneg Shabbos, of enjoying Shabbos. But if you do that on Hanukkah, there are no points at all. You have to make sure, if you're having a Hanukkah party, then you have to discuss words of Torah. That's, of course, besides the Mitzvah Hayom, which is, there is a Mitzvah Sachila, where you have to have a kezias of either sufganiyot or latkes every single day of Hanukkah. That's an absolute obligation that one is required to do that. I'm just kidding. There's no obligation to eat anything over Hanukkah, but there is this minhag to use fried foods because the oil was part of the miracle of Hanukkah, the extra oil that the menorah burned for longer. So therefore, in remembrance of that, then we should use eat foods fried in oil. You can make an argument that we should use olive oil to fry the foods. And we've been discussing between Mincha Ma'ariv and Shabbos whether there's a hider to use olive oil to light the menorah. So if there's a hider to use olive oil to light the menorah because it's closer to the oil in the Beis Hamikdash, maybe there's a hider to fry your foods in olive oil because it's a remembrance of the oil in the base of Mikdash Mor. So that's not the commonly accepted custom, but okay, if you want to use olive oil, it's good. It's probably healthier than the oils that they used to use in Europe. They used to use schmaltz. Again, schmaltz in moderation is fine. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with schmaltz, but that's a story about the frying. Technically speaking, the mitzvah of the Hanukkah candles is one candle per household per night. One candle on the first night, one candle on the second night, one candle on the third night, etc. But there is, we have the universal custom nowadays that we observe what's called in the Gemara, Mahadrin Mina Mahadrin, the most ideal way to observe the mitzvah, which is that you start with one candle the first night, a second candle the second night, and a third candle the third night, etc., and you keep going. There's a major disagreement between the Rishonim as to whether this is also for each person in the household or only one per household. So here we have different practices among the Sfardim and the Ashkenazim. I don't want to go into it now, but it's not so clear that these two opinions are actually reflected in the Rishonim per se in the exact way that the Minhag is practiced nowadays. But by Ashkenazim, we generally have every person in the household light their own menorah. The Mishnah Berurah quotes Poskim who say that nevertheless, the husband and wife can lay one menorah together because of the principle of Ishto Kegufo, that a person's wife is like himself. So not everybody agrees with that. And certainly if a wife wants to light her own menorah, so it's perfectly fine to do so. But those who do not do so, that's also perfectly fine. There's nothing halachically wrong because, as I said, technically speaking, one menorah for the entire household would technically suffice. So Ashkenazim, each person generally lights their own menorah. And in Sephardic households, they light only one menorah for the entire household. Both minhagim are good. The time for lighting the menorah should really be done about 10 to 20 minutes after sunset. So a lot of people are not home at that time in the winter because it's in the middle of the afternoon. So it's going to be at about, I don't know, is it 4:45 or something is there really the correct time for lighting a Hanukkah candle? It's right after sunset when it starts getting a little bit dark. Properly, it should be done before a nightfall, but after sunset when it's getting a little bit dark. That's not proper to delay more. Really, ideally, people should come home from work and light at the proper time. So one of the perhaps hidden blessings of COVID is that people are working from home and they'll be able to light the Hanukkah candles at the proper time. So everybody should make more effort this year to light the Hanukkah candles at the proper time. People are not capable of doing that because they're at work or whatever, school or whatever. So there are leniencies to light later, and these leniencies are for two reasons. One reason is that people nowadays are generally out and about for later than they used to be in the times of the Gemara. That the Gemara says, you know, it seems to say that, as interpreted by many Rishonim, that you only basically have a half an hour after the correct time to still be able to light candles. So that means you only really have until 5:15, 5:30, something like that, whatever, to light the candles. So a lot of people are not home even by then. So the reason you could light later is because that Gemara's figure is going, or the Rishonim interpreting the Gemara, their figure is going in the olden days where people did not stay out at night late, but nowadays the people stay out at night late, so it's you could light later. And also because that the Rishonim say that the main point of the Hanukkah candles nowadays is to light for the benefit of the people living in the house. In the times of the Gemara, they used to light outside, that the correct place for the Hanukkah candles was actually right outside the door of the house, or some say the door of the courtyard, that all the people in the courtyard used to light together at the entrance of the courtyard. And that would thereby the people who were passing by would see everybody's Hanukkah candles, and it would be a great celebration and a publicization of the mitzvah. So at a certain point in Europe, before that really, even in the times of the Gemara there, this happened, that people, the non-Jews didn't like it. They didn't like these candles there. It was an affront to their Avodah Zarah. They used to steal them, different reasons. So people started lighting Hanukkah candles inside. So if you're lighting Hanukkah candles inside and the only people who are seeing it are really the people who live in the house, then you could light later even when people in the street are not walking by. So these are leniencies that people rely on if necessary, that in a normal year when people are working from work and they're not working from home, but you should make every effort, even in a normal year, it's proper to light at the proper time anyway. And certainly this year, where more people will be working from home, then it's we should make an effort to light at the proper time. The candle should burn for at least half an hour after nightfall. But it's proper for them to burn a little bit longer so people have more time to enjoy them. Certainly if you're lighting in a place where it could be seen from the outside, from the street, so it's proper to have the candles burning a little bit longer so people, as they're coming home from work and people are really out and about, they'll be able to see the candle light. Nowadays, if you live in an apartment building, so you should light in the window, even though it's more than 20 amos from the street level. Normally, Hanukkah candles are not supposed to be higher than 20 amos tall. So what are we going to do? People live on the fourth, fifth, third floor, maybe it's still under 20 amos, but fourth, fifth, sixth, and the higher floors, what are you going to do? So the answer is that maybe if there's a street level, or maybe some say even if there are apartments across from you that can see the Hanukkah candle, so that's good enough. And even though it's higher than 20 amos from the street right outside, then that's where you should light. So that's where we normally try to light in the apartment building. You try to light it in the window. However, remember, according to the Gemara, the basic place where you're really supposed to light, unless you really don't have any doorway that leads to the Rishus HaRamim, to the street outside. So you're supposed to light outside the door. So the question is, so some say that in an apartment building, you really have two options. Really, you should either light outside the apartment door, or you should light on the entrance to the building. So these two options, even though they might be, it's not so clear, not 100% clear, but it's possible that might be more preferable to lighting in the window. Nevertheless, it's a bit impractical. I don't think your landlord wants you lighting candles by the entrance to your apartment door on the left side, and they certainly don't want you to light at the entrance to the building. So that's somewhat impractical. So that's why the general custom is to light in the window. I had an idea where you could maybe put an electric light that, even though we don't really hold like this, that we normally assume, as we're going to discuss between Mincha and Ma'ariv on Shabbos, we normally assume that an electric light is absolutely invalid for the Hanukkah candles, because unlike Shabbos, where electric candles are acceptable for the mitzvah of lighting Shabbos candles, because there the whole point is to illuminate the room. So any type of light is acceptable. The Hanukkah candles, the whole point is to do something unusual. The whole point is to remember the menorah and the Beis HaMikdash. So therefore, the vast majority of poskim assume that electric lights are absolutely invalid for lighting Hanukkah candles, unless you have just no choice. What if you're in the hospital or something over Hanukkah and they don't let you light candles in any way? So then you have no choice. Better than nothing. I don't know if you should make the bracha, but it's better than nothing. So I thought of this idea that if you live in an apartment building, so light the Hanukkah candles in the window. It's safer. And then take one electric light, because remember, technically you're Yotze with one light per night. Put one electric light on the door at the entrance to your apartment on the left, and another electric light at the entrance to the building. So you're looking at me with funny looks. You think that's too sticky and cute, but I thought maybe it's a good idea. Maybe it's a good idea to do such a thing. I have to see if it's going to be practical this year. I'll see if I'll be able to do it. But again, the main Hanukkah candles are the ones which are in the window. All right. So we actually have. Motzi,
what? If you're being motzi your wife.
Yeah.
I'm home on time. She's working later. Am I waiting for her? Does she have to be there when I light? If I'm being if Ishto Kagufo.
Will she be offended if you light on time when she's not present?
That I don't know. But I'm working from home because of COVID. She's still at work. I can be motzi her without her being there, you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because the chiyuv is on the household. So you can be you can be motzi anyone who lives with you. Your kids don't have to light, technically. Again, the minhag is they do, but technically yeah. Your kids don't have to light your own. Technically, technically nobody has a say. You could say, everybody, I'm lighting one candle. And for the whole household, and that's it. You could do that. You'll be Yotze. the mitzvah. So you're the balabas, not only over the household, but of the over the mitzvah. But your wife, certainly, if she's not lighting her own menorah anyway, it's absolutely that she'd be yotze with you. The question is, yeah, if she, you know her, you can tell her if she's, you can tell if she's being honest or not. So you ask her, honey, I want to light Hanukkah candles on time. How will you feel if you're not home when I light the Hanukkah candles at the proper time at 4:45 or whatever it is? And she'll either tell you, yes, I'll be really offended, in which case she'll wait for her. She'll wait for her. We can rely on the coolest about this. Or she might say, I'm excited by the idea of being Yotze Hanukkah candles in the most most ideal way. So please go ahead without me and light Hanukkah candles at the proper time. And most tzur will sing together when I get home. Most tzur, you don't have to sing within the zman of lighting the candles. So it depends. If you think she's being honest, then she's not just saying that to placate you. So then, yeah, so I will definitely light it at the proper time. The famous story, the Chofetz Chaim was by his Rebbe, Reb Nochemka of Haradna. Very famous story, where Reb Nochemka was known to be very medaktik b'mitzvos, extremely machmir, extremely careful about all the mitzvos. And so the Chofetz Chaim was there visiting him on Hanukkah, so they may be staying with him even. And the time for lighting the candles came and went, and he didn't light Hanukkah candles. The Chofetz Chaim is thinking, what's this? Reb Nochemka is not lighting candles? Lighting Hanukkah candles, at least not at the proper time. He's so careful about all the halachas. How could it be that Reb Nochemka is not lighting the candles at the proper time? So then, a few minutes later, Reb Nochemka's wife came walking in the door, and immediately Reb Nochemka got up and lit the Hanukkah candles without further ado. So he explained to the Chofetz Chaim. He says that I know my wife is going to be offended if she's not here when I light the candles. So therefore, I wait for her. There's a, and they give a cute allusion in the, based on a different halacha, which is that if you only can afford Hanukkah candles or Shabbos candles, which one should you buy? Shabbos candles, because Shabbos candles facilitate and foster shalom bayis. That when there's light in the house on Shabbos, so then people are in a better mood and it helps with the relationship between the husband and wife. So we set aside the mitzvah of Hanukkah candles in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Shabbos candles. It's because of the issue of Shalom Bayis. So Reb Nochemka said, well, if the mitzvah of Shalom Bayis sets aside Hanukkah candles, so I can certainly light the candles later and rely on the more lenient opinions if my wife is going to be offended, if it's going to affect my Shalom Bayis to light the candles on time. But okay, Reb Nochemka's wife was not on board with this. But if a different person's wife is on board with this, so like I said, it is a good idea, better to light the Hanukkah candles at the proper time. What is it, 4:45? We can look up the exact time later. Okay, so a lot of interesting things about Hanukkah, and there's actually a connection between Hanukkah and the parsha. Switching far now. That the parsha this week is parsha Vayishlach. Oh, by the way, the halacha that I just told you that the buying Hanukkah candles sets aside, I'm sorry, that buying Shabbos candles is more important than buying Hanukkah candles does not apply nowadays because everybody has electric lights. So if you're the whole point is that there should be Shalom Bayis. So if you could use electric lights for the Shabbos light, Shabbos candles, so then use more. It's better to buy Hanukkah candles. I hope this will not be relevant to anyone that they're so needy that they won't be able to afford both Shabbos candles and the Hanukkah candles. If that applies to anyone, or you know anyone to whom that might apply, so I have discretionary funds for use for such purposes. So there is a connection between Hanukkah and the Parsha. Well, I won't be landing this Parsha on Hanukkah, but we'll be approaching Hanukkah when we land this Parsha on Shabbos. So it says, famously, there's the famous Rashi, that Yaakov is going to greet his brother Esav, and he tells the messengers to tell Esav, Im Lavan Garti Voicharad Ata, with I have dwelled with Lavan, and I have delayed until now. Vayicharata im Lavan garti. I've dwelled with Lavan. So one of the pshatim in Rashi that he says, one of the drushim, maybe better, that Rashi says is that garti, if you rearrange the letters of garti, I have dwelled, you come up with Taryag. And what's the gematria? 613. So the famous Rashi says that what Yaakov Avinu wanted the messengers to tell Esav was, I have dwelled with Lavan, and I nevertheless have observed the 613 mitzvos. Now, setting aside for a second the issue as to if the Avos, if the forefathers actually kept the Torah, where they kept the Torah, it's a whole shaila, the different approaches amongst the commentators as to whether the forefathers observed the mitzvos of the Torah. Some say yes, some say no, some say only, some say they volunteered to perform most of them, but if they, what things they didn't want to do, they didn't have to perform. Some say they only observed the mitzvos in Eretz Yisrael and not in Chutz Laretz, and that's how Yaakov Avinu was allowed to marry two sisters. So that's not allowed. It says in Sefer Vayikra that you're not allowed to marry two sisters at the same time. One is the only situation where a man is allowed to marry two sisters. When the first one dies. After one sister dies, then you're allowed to marry the second sister. This happened many times in Jewish history because, if the couple was blessed with children, so then they're going to need a foster mother. So what better foster mother could there be? A stepmother, I'm sorry, not foster mother, a stepmother. What better stepmother could there be than the aunt of the children? She already loves them and knows them. They're her sister's children. So many, many times in Jewish history, it was a very common shidduch that if a man's wife died, so then he would go ahead and marry her sister. This does not apply. If they get divorced, that's no good. You divorce the first sister, you are still not allowed to marry the sister. It's only death allows one to marry the other sister. Okay. So that's how Yaakov Avinu could marry two sisters, because they got married in Chutz Laretz and they only observed the Torah in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, you all have all these different approaches to this issue of whether the forefathers observed the Torah. Okay, so anyway, the kash on this Rashi is, what's the kash on this Rashi? Why on earth is Yaakov telling Esav he observed 613 mitzvos? Who cares? Esav cares if Yaakov observes the mitzvos? What difference does it make? Why is he saying this as a point of pride? So some want to answer as follows, and a very important message for nowadays, a very important message for the time of Hanukkah. Jews tend to think completely backwards about a certain issue. As we know throughout Jewish history, a lot of times the Jews think that the Goyim will like them better if they copy, if they assimilate, if they give up their religion, if they give up their traditions, if they give up their uniqueness and try to assimilate to the Goyim as much as possible. So this is telling you, Rabbozai, it's just the opposite. The reason Yaakov Avinu told Esav, I observe the mitzvos, I still observe the mitzvos, even though I was living with Lavan for so long, is because Yaakov Avinu knew that non-Jews respect Jews more when they stick up for their beliefs deep down. I mean, they might not show it right away, but overall, if Jews would be very consistent with their traditions, so the non-Jews really respect us more. And you hear stories like this in Kiruv seminars, that the stories of how a frum person will meet a non-Jew, and again, assuming they're really frum, they keep everything, the ethical things as well as the ritual things, and they're good, decent people to all people, and I greet everyone, Jews and non-Jews, Sefer Panim Yafos, with a nice way of greeting, with proper respect and a good demeanor, that they respect the whole package more, much more than Jews who try to blend in and they try to assimilate. So it's a very important lesson that the truth is that assimilation does nothing for us, and in the long run, the non-Jews respect us less for being not from than for being from. And anyway, there's no getting out of it. My wife told me a joke the other day. Milsa dibdichusa, keep your attention in the shir. That my wife told me a joke that there was a Jew who wanted to join a country club. Oh no, she didn't tell me the joke. Someone else told me the joke. Take it back. Someone else said the joke. Heard it somewhere else. That a Jew wanted to join a country club, and they didn't allow Jews in this country club. So the Jew, Shmerel, goes to the head of the country club and says, "What do I have to do to join the country club?" So the head of the country club says, "You have to become a Christian. You have to go to Shmad." He didn't use the word Shmad, but you have to go to Shmad. So the Jew goes to Shmad. He gets baptized, and he becomes a member of the country club. So after many years, he gets up. Many years as a good member of the country club. It seems to fit him very well. After many years, he's the guest of honor at the country club's dinner, and he gets up. He gives the greeting of his speech and starts to give a speech. So he sits down. He sits down after giving the speech, and the president of the country club says, "Shmerel, you know, I really would think after all these years, you would not still be opening your speeches to the country club with greetings, my fellow goyim." Anyway. There's no getting out of it, shall we say. As we know, that's what we say. I say this over every year on Tisha B'Av, not exactly the appropriate time right now, but you see throughout Jewish history that whatever the type of anti-Semitism that existed followed us around, depending on how we were trying to escape it. So for most of Jewish history, where the vast majority of the Jewish people were observant, Torah observant Jews, so the persecution was based on religion. If you wanted to not be persecuted anymore, in medieval Spain and whatever place, if you wanted not to be persecuted as a Jew anymore, you converted to Christianity and that was it. You wouldn't be persecuted anymore. You'd more or less be accepted as a full member of society. But that was obviously very uncommon. The Jews stood fast to their religion and didn't give in. But after a while, when the religious persecution was not so relevant anymore, because the Jews were very happily giving up their religion, say in 19th century Germany in a lot of cases, so the method of anti-Semitism changed that. It became racial anti-Semitism. What did Hitler say? Hitler said, "You want to convert to Christianity? It doesn't matter." He had a totally different approach. He said, "It doesn't matter. We hate you racially. We're going to get rid of you. We're going to get rid of you anyway." So you see that the type of anti-Semitism catches up to us. And nowadays in America, it's again based on beliefs that people persecute Orthodox Jews for maintaining certain beliefs that are not in consonance with the orthodoxies, if you'll excuse the word, of certain segments of the secular world. I forgot the chat. Who doesn't mention the lasting for 8 days?
The Book of the Maccabees.
What?
The Book of the Maccabees doesn't.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true. Not all the sources.
And Josephus doesn't.
Yeah, so people want to say, if the more scholarly academic inclined, so if you're not inclined to that approach, so cover your ears right now, but the more scholarly academic approach is that This miracle was only emphasized in the Talmud Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, because they weren't as in touch. Maybe they were afraid about Jews getting ideas about taking up arms and rebelling. So they emphasized the miracle of the oil, whereas the other sources and more emphasized the military victory.
That's true.
That's true that now these sources mentioned the miracle of the oil. Someone else suggested, what if the husband, talking about the correct time for lighting Hanukkah candles, so what if the husband lights at the proper time and the wife lights when she gets home, or even vice versa, you could say. If the wife is home, you know, there we could be really feminist. That maybe in a regular year, if the wife is home, she's just a homemaker, not just a homemaker, it's a very important job. I didn't make this sound belittling. If she's at home most of the day, so and the husband's at work, so you can make a very, very strong halachic argument that in fact the wife should just light Hanukkah candles at the proper time and let the husband not light. Let her light at the proper time and let the husband come home and let them sing Mozart together when it'll be later. So you don't really need to do that. You could do that. But once she was Yotze already, so unless they always, the husband and wife always light a separate menorah, in which case you could. I don't see what exactly halachically that gets you, but if emotionally it makes you feel better, so that is a possibility. But most women don't like to light their own menorah. Most women, in my experience, I think classically, the classic approach, again, I'm not talking, it's not saying this is correct, I'm not saying you shouldn't do otherwise, but classically speaking, most women want to be yotzei things with their husbands. They do not want to do things for themselves. They don't want to make their own kiddush and hamotzi and all these things. They want specifically their husband to be motzi them. And as Rav Schechter explains, it was like a superstition almost. I don't know if we should really call it that, but that a woman doing all these things for herself was associated with being a widow. That a woman, an almana makes kiddush for herself on Shabbos. So therefore, women felt uncomfortable because it felt like being an almana. Okay. Good. There's a lot more to discuss in the parsha. We don't have so much time left, unfortunately. We'll just discuss quickly another little bit about assimilation. We're on that topic in the parsha. So we have the famous midrashim that talk about, it mentions how it says in Genesis chapter 32, verse 23, it says, Achad asar yeladov. It counts the number of children of Yaakov Avinu as 11. What's the problem with that? How many children were there at that time? 12. Binyamin wasn't born yet. But 11 of the tribes were born, plus Dina. So there were 12 children. So why does the Pasuk say 11 children? So we can give various answers, maybe some that are more Pshat-oriented. But the famous Medrash says that Dina was not counted, because Yaakov Avinu did not present Dina to Esav along with the other children. Rather, Yaakov Avinu put her in a box. Why did Yaakov Avinu put her in a box? In order that Esav shouldn't see her and want to marry her. And Allah also, this is permissible for a man to marry his niece. Not a very common shidduch nowadays, but halachically it is acceptable to do that. But Yaakov Avinu did not want his brother Esav, because his brother Esav was bad, wicked. So he didn't want them to develop any sort of connection for Esav to know she existed, and Esav would want to marry her. And then it says that Yaakov was punished for this by the episode of Dina later. Again, how Yaakov could have been punished when it was something bad that happened to Dina, okay, we could discuss. But it says that Yaakov was not right to do this. He was not right to put her in a box because maybe she would have married Esav and brought him around and returned him to be a good Jew, to use an anachronistic term. That so therefore he should not have put her in the box, and he should have let Esav see her. So some of the commentators on Rashi, so on the Sifsei Chachomim, the classic commentator on Rashi, ask a very simple question. Would you allow your daughter to go in front of Esav? Who would want the daughter to go in front of Esav? What, maybe she should marry him and he'd return to do good? What are you talking about? It's crazy. You send young Jewish girls to secular college to tempt the goyim so that maybe they'll get married and they'll convert the goyim to and then they'll be good Jews? Crazy. Of course you don't put someone in that temptation. Of course you don't. That's bad, and that's not good for a young woman, because maybe she'll be a good influence on her husband. You never make a shidduch expecting the other person to change. That's a recipe for disaster. So why was Yaakov punished for this? Seems like it was a good choice. It's a good kasha, no? So it's not so plush. Maybe some of the commentators suggest, I seem to say Roman brings someone who suggests that maybe Yaakov Avinu saw that she by nature was such an influential person, meaning that she could influence others to do good by nature, and she would never be drawn in herself to do anything bad, no matter in what horrible situation she found herself in. That he should have perceived that she was capable of doing this. But obviously, for a regular person, this would obviously not be the correct course of action. We should try to keep our daughters away from people who are not proper husbands for them. Do you have any other suggestions? I'd be happy to entertain them. Then we have the story with Dina again, where Dina, it says that she, of course, was raped. A very bad thing happened to Dina by Shechem. But it says, "Vateitze Dina basliol liros bivnos haaretz." How did this whole thing start out? And let me give a disclaimer before I even say this Dvar Torah. Before when I speak, I've gotten improperly, in my opinion, criticized before when I spoke about the story of Dina based on contemporary standards of how one speaks about rape. But I am not saying at all, we're not saying that it's Dina's fault, and if she got, you know, she didn't conduct herself, so we blame her for the story. Absolutely not, as you see very clearly, that the sons of Yaakov punished Shechem very much for doing this this terrible deed, and you see it was a horrible thing he did, and he got what he deserved. Essentially, he got death for committing a rape. So we are not saying that, but the fact that the Torah throws in here the words liros bivnos haaretz, that the whole situation got started because she went to see what the bivnos haaretz, the daughters of the land, were doing. She was too curious about what the surrounding culture is, their fashions, you know, where she wanted to see which malls they shopped at. She wanted to see where, you know, which designers they wore, which fashions, how short they wore their skirts, whatever. She wanted to see how they wore their makeup, how they even less more innocuous things. I don't know how they studied for their tests, what subjects they were learning in school. She was too curious and interested in what the surrounding, the daughters of the surrounding tribes and nations were doing. So again, not to blame her for what actually happened, but the Torah is telling you that it cannot lead to good things when we're too curious about what's going on in the outside world. Again, we have to know a little bit about what's going on in the outside world, but it says Vateitze Dina. She went out to see specifically. She left her comfort zone. She left her family in order to try to copy, in order to try to absorb the mentalities and the mores of the girls and the surrounding tribes. So you see that that is a very, very bad thing for Jewish girls. But, well, I would say especially because that's what it's discussed in the pasuk, but for any Jew of any gender to do, not to go out and make a point of being overly concerned and interested with the surrounding cultures. Again, also a very important story of Hanukkah that, that led to the destruction on Hanukkah before the Maccabees freed everyone, because that's when the Jews... You know, a lot of the issues were not caused by Syrian Greeks who were invading Eretz Yisrael, but rather there was the Hellenists, there was the Jews who wanted specifically to give up Judaism and to copy more of the Greek culture, Greek norms, Greek study, Greek methods of entertainment. That that caused a lot of problems for the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, who wanted to remain committed to the Judaism of their forefathers. I mean, you know, this has all been always a problem. That it's often Jews, not committed Jews, who cause more problems to firm Jews than goyim. As I said before, goyim respect firm Jews when they act properly. But there's the famous story. I'll tell you another joke to end off this year, that there was a Jewish woman, an assimilated or reformed Jewish woman, whatever, boarded a bus in New York City. And she sees a man with a long beard and an old hat, you know, old, very old style hat and a long black coat. She goes up to him and she says, "You Hasidim are a disgrace. You don't dress nicely. You speak Yiddish. Why can't you just be American, a little bit more modern? You're so stuck in the past. It's terrible." So the man says to this this old secular Jewish lady, "Ma'am, excuse me. I think you have the wrong idea. I'm Amish." So the old Jewish lady says, "Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I think it's so beautiful how committed you are to preserving your traditions and, you know, your insularity in the modern world. It's such a beautiful thing." So often our biggest enemies are, unfortunately, our fellow Jews who have thrown off the yoke, not just the yoke, but the beauty and the connection to the mitzvos and to the Mesorah of Klal Yisrael from generation to generation. It's precisely that that we celebrate on Hanukkah. That it's actually funny that in some ways that Reformed Jews celebrate Hanukkah. There was a famous article in the New York Times a few years ago written by a Reformed Jew that said, he was the first one to realize this, but it's an obvious hara. Reformed Jew, he says, "Hey, wait a minute. Why do Reform Jews celebrate Hanukkah? Well, you shouldn't be celebrating the Maccabees' victory. We would have been on the other side. We should be unhappy about the victory." They're right. The Taka right. Reform Jews should not celebrate Hanukkah. Meretz Hashem on Thursday night, we will celebrate Hanukkah and be very proud. We will let the light of the Torah that celebrate that's symbolized by the candles. We know that candle and light, ner mitzvah v'sora or, that the Torah is a light to all the nations of the world, but especially to the Jewish people. We celebrate the light of the Torah dispelling the darkness of the lack of Torah, the depravity, the lack of control, the lack of structure, the lack of holiness that's found in the world around us. And a little bit of Torah, a little bit of light can diffuse through a lot of darkness and make a major, major impact. And it's this that we celebrate on Thursday night and throughout Hanukkah. And we have to conduct our whole lives accordingly. We have to make a Kiddush Hashem. We have to act properly and completely observe the Torah in a way that's pleasant and wonderful, both in the eyes of God and the eyes of our fellow human beings of all religions and races, and truly allow the light to penetrate the world. Wish everyone a good Shabbos, and a Freilichen Chanukah.
Shabbos Yashkoch.
Shabbos Yashkoch.
Shabbos.